This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Haney along with Howard Wilkinson. The situation in Iraq poses a critical problem for the U.S. as the first military advisors hit the ground there. Outcomes in primary races this week helped define the midterm elections in November. Recent polls are not kind to President Obama. Hillary Clinton fails to sound like one of the common folk. And New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is facing a second bridge scandal. How many bridges are there in New Jersey anyway? We wade through the latest political news as political junkie Ken Rudin joins us once again. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And hi, Ken. Good afternoon.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure.
Hello. Yeah, good to hear
and
from
Howard.
You.
And Howard. Hi, Howard.
Of course. We can't forget Howard.
How are you? Yeah, we've got a lot to cover today. We've got some breaking news out of the Supreme Court, which kind of dealt a body blow to President Obama with the ruling on the recess appointments.
Yeah, this is what the Republicans have been complaining about for the longest time. Of course, the president, any president, regardless of party, has the right to pick whom they want if the Senate is ostensibly in session. Now, the Republican argument was, well, when President Obama named these people to the National Labor Relations Board, the Senate wasn't really in session, and he violated his oath of office by overstepping his bounds, and the Supreme Court agreed with him.
Does this give any fuel?
The Supreme Court agreed with the opponents, right?
Right,
the Republicans.
Yeah. I mean, does this give any fuel to the fire that Boehner's started about talking about taking the president to court? Over executive
well, that's
actions?
Well, I mean, that's part of it. Of course, it's one thing for John Boehner to do a political thing saying that, you know, we're going to take President Obama to court for, we're going to sue him for executive action. Of course, maybe Obama could take Congress to court for executive inaction, congressional right. inaction. Mm-hmm. But it's one thing for Boehner to do a political thing like that. It's another thing for the Supreme Court to rule. And of course, the Supreme Court ruling is really a body blow.
So, Ken, you have a trivia question for us today?
Well, I do. I mean, the big political news of the week, of course, was Thad Cochran, shockingly, winning the primary on Tuesday in Mississippi. And, of course, he's been in the Senate since 1978. And you know that there have been so much talk about all this long seniority in the Senate. Dick Lugar was trying for a seventh term 2 years ago when he lost. Robert Byrd of West Virginia was there for more than a half century. Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, also just about as long. And so the question, but the opposite question is, which Ohio senator in the last 50 years, which Ohio senator served the shortest amount of time in the Senate?
Okay. Yeah.
Mark, this is what we do on Cincinnati Edition.
Okay. My brain already hurts. So.
I think I'm with you.
The answer is not Frank Lauschy. Right.
Yeah.
Well, and if you happen to think you know the answer, you want to take a guess at it, or you know for sure, give us a call at 513-419-7100 to answer Ken's trivia question of the day. 513-419-7100.
All right. Well, let's talk about Thad Cochran, because I thought that was one of the most interesting primaries I've seen in a long time. I mean, he barely ekes this thing out, or actually it was a runoff, a Republican runoff.
Well, what's so fascinating about this is that we're always amazed when the longtime incumbents lose. Like when Eric Cantor lost 2 weeks ago in Virginia, how does somebody so powerful lose? This time we were predicting that the longtime incumbent would lose because, one, he seemed out of touch. Two, his campaign organization had atrophied. They hadn't really had any reason, because I think there's a law in Mississippi that that Democrats are not allowed to be elected to the Senate. So therefore you don't never have to worry about it once you're in office. And two, the Tea Party was fired up. They were fired up about Chris McDaniel, the conservative opponent. They were angry at Thad Cochran's long reliance on earmarks and pork projects. You know, once upon a time you would get reelected by talking about how much money you brought home to the state, but that's a dirty word to Tea Party folks. And so the feeling was that given Thad Cochran's slow motion campaign, slow to realize that he was in serious trouble, and the energy behind the Tea Party, a lot of people thought Thad Cochran was going to lose, but nobody suspected African-Americans, African-American Democrats, would play a huge role in getting a Republican senator reelected.
And they did crossover votes.
Right.
And Cochran's campaign encouraged this.
Well, right. In Mississippi, there is no registering by party, so you can vote in either primary you want. Yeah. And of course, the only people, if you voted in the Democratic primary on June 3rd, then you couldn't vote in the Republican runoff. But Thad Cochran, who is still a conservative, but I mean, he has supported voting rights, and God forbid a Republican supports voting rights, right? But I mean, he's done a lot of things that the African American community favorite, and at the same time, you had somebody like Chris McDaniel, who talked about our way of life, and there was a lot of racial overtones, you know, some thoughts about racial hints about behind the scenes kind of language that McDaniel would use. So blacks felt, well, look, you know, we're not Republicans, but anybody who's campaigning as Chris McDaniel is to end federal money for Mississippi, well, that's against our best interest, and we're going to come out for Thad Cochran. Pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there are a lot of people in Mississippi, including those African-American voters, who don't mind pork coming into their state.
Well, if you look at, I mean, not only does Mississippi have the largest African-American population percentage in the country, but there's dire poverty in Mississippi, and that's not going to, I mean, you could say that, well, what has all this federal largesse done to alleviate that? And some conservatives say, well, it's done nothing. But at the same time, if there's so much poverty, if there's so many people just doing poorly in Mississippi, why would you not want federal aid coming in from Washington? Thad Cochran always brought it in. McDaniel said it was time for a stop to that. And the African-American community said that's suicide for us. So they came out and voted with their... They made their case with their votes in Republican ballots. It's just pretty remarkable.
Ken, do you think, are there signs from the primaries that the Tea Party is starting to gather some new momentum, that they're starting to make a comeback on the political scene? They upset Cantor, and they came close to knocking off Thad Cochran.
Well, there is that argument. There's also the argument that one of their big targets was Mitch McConnell. One of their big targets was Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. What McConnell and Lindsey Graham and others seem to have done is they've learned the lesson of the past two cycles, when a lot of Republicans were just caught flat-footed by this Tea Party challenge. Robert Bennett in Utah, Dick Lugar in Indiana. For different reasons, those guys went down to defeat from Tea Party challengers. And McConnell and Lindsey Graham and others said, wait a second, we're going to learn the lesson. Also, the Republican establishment candidate in North Carolina, Tom Tillis, another one, they all said, we learned the lesson of our Republicans who went down to defeat in previous cycles. We're going to be prepared, and we're going to maybe move a little more conservative, but we're certainly going to get our moribund campaign organization off its behind and get them very active. And that's what they did. So for all the headlines to say, well, the Tea Party is on the ascendancy, they beat Eric Cantor, they got a nominee they like in Nebraska, blah, blah, blah. There's also arguments to say that, you know, they may have overreached in trying to get Cochran and McConnell and North Carolina and Lindsey Graham. I mean, whatever you want to say, did they come close? Yes, but ultimately, you know, it's like horseshoes. Whoever, the winner is the winner. And right now, at least in Tuesday's runoff, the Tea Party was a loser in Mississippi.
Overall, I mean, how do you think they stand in terms of the fall election?
Well, you know, they came to power in 2010, and their targets in 2010 were Democrats, Democratic incumbents, and the Obama administration. In succeeding years, it seems like their targets have really been Republicans and the RINO, RINO is short for rhinoceros. No, RINO is short for Republican in name only. And so they've gone after establishment Republicans. You know, when Eric Cantor lost, and of course there was a new majority leader election in among Republicans in Washington, a lot of people thought that the Tea Party would make a bid to become, you know, to fill that void, and they didn't. An even more liberal Republican, Kevin McCarthy of California, won that election. Now, you did have a conservative, Steve Scalise, winning the whip election. But the thing is, it's hard to make the case. They still hope to beat Lamar Alexander in the August 7th Tennessee primary. They're still looking at Pat Roberts in Kansas. They'd like to beat him too. But the question is who the real enemy is for the Tea Party. Is it Obama and the Democrats? Of course, there are not many vulnerable Democrats left. A lot of them got knocked off in 2010. And so right now, their focus seems to be the Republican Party. So as bad as President Obama's numbers have been, and they have been bad, The Republican brand is not doing so great either, and they're still fighting among themselves.
And Ken, when it comes to Eric Cantor, you know, there was the initial thought that it was immigration reform that did him in. Now I'm starting to wonder if it was a perception that he was more interested in becoming the next House Speaker or rising up the GOP leadership as opposed to serving the people of his district. I mean, the guy ran up $165,000 on a steakhouse bill, so, you know, what are his constituents thinking when they see that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair, accurate comment. I mean, yes, there are people who said that because Eric Cantor did entertain ideas of immigration overhaul, immigration became a significant issue, and his Republican opponent, the guy who beat him, David Bratt, basically Bratt said, well, immigration is one of the reasons we need to stop Eric Cantor, and a lot of conservative talk show hosts like Laura Ingraham also said that immigration is the big issue. And the headlines the next day said, well, now that Eric Cantor's lost, maybe we Republicans, it would be foolhardy for us to even entertain talking to President Obama about immigration, because look what happened to Eric Cantor. But I think you're right, Mark. I mean, it's also the fact that he was measuring the drapes for Speaker of the House whenever John Boehner would quit. And so by doing so, he probably had a more of a national vision and a national outlook than he did in the 7th Congressional District in Virginia. And a lot of voters back home took it personally.
And the one thing that Boehner has that I don't think Cantor had was a district staff that did the job in the district. You know, if you had a problem, you can call Boehner's office, you know, in the district, and they'll take care of it for you.
That's true. And there was also Cantor's district was radically redrawn in 2012. If anything, it made it more conservative, more Republican. But in doing so, it made it more rural, more conservative. And of course, a lot of the district was unfamiliar to him. So it wasn't until maybe a couple of weeks before the primary when his people said, we could be in trouble. And yet his pollster still had him winning with 65%. I wonder where that pollster is employed right now. But his staff seemed to be completely unprepared for what happened 2 weeks ago.
Hey, Ken, before we hit the break, could we get you to repeat the trivia question again?
Well, we're talking about all this long seniority on Capitol Hill, you know, Thad Cochran and all that. But I'd like to know the senator from Ohio in the last 50 years who served the shortest amount of time in the Senate.
Okay, and if you'd like to try your hand at that question, the phone number to call, 513-419-7100. And we'll continue our talk with political junkie Ken Rudin after the break. Again, that number to call for the trivia question, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, along with Howard Wilkinson and Ken Rudin. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
Ken, one of the things that I found interesting in the last week or so, Elizabeth Warren, Democratic senator from Massachusetts, is about to embark on this campaign for Democratic Senate candidates around the country. She was beating up on Mitch McConnell the other day, and she's going to come and do some events for Allison Lundgren Grimes in Kentucky, which is kind of ironic because Grimes is a very close friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton, and Warren is possibly just laying out some IOUs in case she decides to run against Hillary.
Well, I mean, first of all, Elizabeth Warren says she is not going to run, and I take her at her word.
Yeah.
Having said that, there are a lot of progressives in this country, progressive Democrats, who feel that all the things that's wrong with Hillary Clinton, the fact that she, you know, makes these $200,000 speeches, that she's close to Wall Street, that she's close to the corporate culture that a lot of Democrats attack the Republicans for. Elizabeth Warren is not that person. Elizabeth Warren is, you know, a proud Wall Street basher. She has a very progressive record. Mm-hmm. And she's the kind of person, the lack of caution, you know, I mean, everybody, you think of Hillary Clinton being very cautious, very unwilling to say anything controversial. And yet Elizabeth Warren says, look, this is how I feel. And boom, I'm going with it. I mean, a lot of people feel that Elizabeth Warren is the candidate they wish Hillary Clinton was. I don't think Warren and Hillary Clinton are rivals. I certainly don't think they're going to run against each other in 2016.
Yeah.
But you know, she is the kind of person that a lot of progressives can warm up to.
I mean, can she help any of these Senate candidates?
Well, you know, you know that Barack Obama is not going to come into Kentucky, right, campaigning for Alison Grimes.
No.
And you know that, and you just wonder what a very liberal, let's face it, a very liberal center like Elizabeth Warren could do in Kentucky, given the fact that if you look at least on the presidential level and the Senate level, Kentucky is a pretty conservative state. I mean, they haven't elected a Democrat since, I guess, Wendell Ford left in, was it, 98?
Yeah.
You know, while they elect Democrat governors, they're not wild-eyed liberals. And to many, and perhaps to the McConnell camp, Elizabeth Warren is a wild-eyed liberal. So I don't know if it backfires, but certainly it doesn't hurt Elizabeth Warren if she does have national ambitions.
We've got some people lined up to try the trivia question, Ken, and let's start with Tim in Green Township. And Tim, thank you for waiting so long. We appreciate it. What do you think the answer is?
I think I'll have to go with Native Cincinnati and Robert Taft.
Well, Robert Taft, I mean, of course, the question is who served
one?
The Senate? Which Robert Taft are we talking about?
The Senator Taft.
Well, there were two Senator Taft. There was Robert A. Taft,
right,
who was Mr. Republican, who ran for president against Eisenhower in 1952. And there was the guy who was elected in 1970 when he was elected in 1970 against Howard Metzenbaum. So which one are we talking about?
I was going with Mr. Republican.
Hmm. Well, Mr. Republican, I think he was first elected in 1938, and he died in office in 1953. So that's right there. That's 15 years or so. So Robert Alfonso Taft is not the answer. We're looking for the Ohio senator who served the shortest amount of time in the Senate.
Tim, thanks for trying there. Let's talk with Jeff in Bright, Indiana. Jeff, what do you think the answer is?
I think it's Mike DeWine.
Well, Mike DeWine did serve one term. Of course, he was defeated by Sherrod Brown in 2006. He was elected in 2000, and he served one term. That's 6 years, but that is not the shortest amount of time in the past 50 years.
Can I get a second guess?
No.
No. Nice try, Jeff. Appreciate the attempt there, though.
I mean, if he lived in Chicago, maybe he could vote twice, but not here.
Let's try it. Let's see. Bob in Madeira, do you think you have the answer, Bob?
Hi, was it Howard Metzenbaum?
Well, Howard Metzenbaum.
That would be my guess.
Right. It could be the answer if you gave him an asterisk.
Right.
Remember, he was appointed to the Senate in 1974 and then lost 2 years later. He lost the same year, but he also served 18 years in the Senate. So it's hard to make the case that Howard Metzenbaum served the shortest amount of time, even though his first tenure was only like 12 months, but he also served 18 years. So I'm not going to accept. I'm sorry. I spoke with the judges. We're not going to accept Metzenbaum as the answer.
Wow. Well, thanks, Bob, for making it try.
I'm not an easy kind of guy. You know, I'm not an easy guy.
Well, so far, nobody's gotten it. Want to give it out again, Ken, exactly what we're asking, and then we'll give that phone number and see if we can find somebody out there who knows the answer.
I might give maybe a half a button to the Metzenbaum answer.
Initial thought, yeah.
Well, but he also served 18 years. So, if I said Howard Metzenbaum, when I think of him as a short-term senator, I don't think it's Metzenbaum.
His first stint was very short.
It was 12 months or so.
We have to go full button, no half buttons, full buttons only.
No half button, okay. Okay.
Full button
I
only.
I think that's fair. Yeah, but what Ohio senator served the shortest amount of time in the Senate in the last 50 years?
And if you think you know the answer, 513-419-7100.
Okay, I think I got it, but I'm not sure.
Howard, that's not helping me.
I know it's not helping you.
I don't know anything.
I'm
don't
not
look
trying
at me.
To help. Charlie Rangel, you know, managed to pull it off again. Was that just inevitable, or was
Well, no. It's funny. You know, we talk about Charlie Rangel. He's been in the House since he beat Adam Clayton Powell in 1970 in Harlem. And back in 1970, everybody said, oh, my God, Adam Clayton Powell has been here forever. He's been there for 26 years. And now Charlie Rangel has been in the House for 44 years. Rangel was censured by the Senate for financial misdeeds. They redrew his black majority district to become majority Latino. It used to be just Harlem. Now it's parts of the Bronx and parts of the Upper West Side of Manhattan. So, and he's also, you know, he's like 82 years old. He lost a step. He certainly lost the influence. He had a step down as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee when the Democrats ran the show because of ethics problems. So a lot of people thought that this guy, the state senator named Adriano Espaillat, who lost within 1,000 votes of Rangel 2 years ago, was going to win this time. But, you know, unless Rangel, you know, probably makes a decision on his own, they just can't beat him. The African-American turnout was great, much bigger than the Latino turnout for Espaillat. Espaillat was hoping to become the first Dominican congressman in history. You know, there are more Dominicans in New York than Puerto Ricans, and yet they still have no influence in Congress. But Charlie Rangel just knows how to win, and he says it's going to be his last term, and maybe it will be, and maybe he won't. Maybe he likes to go out on his own terms like John Dingell is doing in Michigan. But right now, you know, a lot of people were surprised that he won, and he won actually by a bigger margin than he did 2 years ago.
I'm not surprised at all. He is the human energizer battery. He keeps going and going and somehow always finds a way.
He does. And you know, they redrew his district, and it was, and of course, once again, there wasn't only one opponent. This time there were three opponents, and it kept Rangel again under 50%, but he still got more votes than his opponent, and that's the name of the game.
And we've got the board lighting up with a lot of people, I believe, who think they know the answer to this question.
I think they think that Charlie Rangel is not the answer, and neither is Howard
Metzenbaum. Yeah. Even though he is a human Timex watch. Let's try Pat in White Oak. What do you think the answer is, Pat?
Robert Taft Jr.
Robert Taft Jr. served the same amount of time as Mike DeWine. He served one term, elected in 70, lost to Metzenbaum in 76. So that's 6 years. That's not the shortest amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, thanks.
Let's, Jim and Milford, give it a try there.
Yes, I guess I need to ask, are term somebody serving currently, does that count? That has
no, it doesn't. That's a good question, no. So it does not include, plus the fact that Portman and Sherrod Brown doesn't include them.
Right, okay. Then William Saxby.
Jim is guessing William Saxby. That is the correct answer.
Ah, there we go.
There we go.
William Saxby is the correct answer. He was elected in 1968, and then he left in January of 1974, a year early, to become Richard Nixon's attorney general. He served 5 years in the Senate. William Saxby is the correct answer.
Way to go, Jim.
Yep.
Now, Jim, hang on the line there.
I got it, too.
Hang on the line
because wait. The inevitable, oh, yeah, Howard. Yeah, I got it, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right, Howard.
Yeah.
I did.
Jim, stay on the line so that we can get your address so we know where to send the full button to. So, congratulations, Jim. Way to go.
Thank you.
And, no, I did. I mean, after thinking for a while, you know, Saxby ended up, obviously, as Nixon's final attorney general.
Right. And if we went even longer, there was a guy named Kingsley Taft. When Harold Burton, the Republican from Ohio, the senator, was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1946, Kingsley Taft won the special election in November of 1946 to fill the last 2 months of Burton's term, but he didn't run for a full term. So Kingsley Taft only served 2 months, but of course that was 1946, beyond the 50-year requirement, according to this question.
What else struck you about this? The primaries on Tuesday.
Hey, quick, I gotta say something. Our apologies, Jim. We lost you there, so we need you to give us a call back. Jim from Milford, give us a call back so we can get your address. Our apologies for that.
Do you know that everybody is going to pretend they're Jim from Milford and give their own address?
Yeah.
You know that.
This is true. You have to show a driver's license when you call in. Yeah, we were talking about the race between Mitch McConnell and Alison Lundgren Grimes, and I'm curious about this, Ken. Mitch McConnell comes in with a plan for the Brent Spence Bridge, and he says, do away with the federal prevailing wage law. That'll save us $13 billion over 10 years, and that's money that could be used on the Brent Spence and for fixing other bridges. And I think he expected it to get a better reception than it did, but his plan seemed to have landed with a very loud thud that perhaps he wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that, But you know, I mean, it's a Republican philosophy, of course, to just cut back spending whenever they can and cut back kind of like government projects. But there are a lot of people who just desperately need those kind of things, and I guess one person's pork is another person's desperate need, so Mitch McConnell's going to have to balance that out, but right now it doesn't sound like he's doing a good job.
Well, I mean, he was suggesting getting rid of the Davis-Bacon Act.
Right.
And that's just not going to happen.
Right. I know in New York, Charles Schumer was getting rid of the Menachem-Bacon Act, which is a different... No, that didn't work.
Well, I mean, the whole issue is this...
Is this a good time to turn off my microphone?
This bridge between Kentucky and Cincinnati, which is in pretty bad shape and needs to be either replaced or restructured. And there's a big argument going on about it, and every politician is forced to talk about it. Grimes has, McConnell has, all of the local politicians have. And Rachel Maddow, even the other night, went on her show and said, hey, you've got John Boehner on one side of the river, and you've got Mitch McConnell on the other side of the river, and the two of them are among the most powerful people in Washington, and they can't resolve this problem with this bridge.
I'm sorry, are they on opposite sides of the issue as well, besides the bridge? I mean, does Boehner want the funding? Does he want the upgrade and the infrastructure repaired?
Well, yeah, but Boehner really hasn't said a whole lot about it. I mean, John Kasich and, the legislature in Ohio have said, yeah, we can pay for this, but it's probably going to take tolls to do it.
And ultimately, Ken, how big of an issue is something like the Brent Spence Bridge? Do you think the Senate races will really turn on more national issues than they will issues that are regional in nature or local in nature?
Well, I confess, and you heard it by my answer, I wasn't aware of this issue. And of course, Tip O'Neill always said, oh, politics is local. And there's truth to that. But 2014 seems to be headed into a national referendum on President Obama. So if you like Obama, you think the Affordable Care Act is working, you think his non-interventionist foreign policy is working, you think the improving economy is working, and then so that's the argument for the Democrats. If you're Republican, you see a disastrous foreign policy, you see a very uneasy economy, you see alleged scandals after scandals between Benghazi and the IRS. I mean, seriously, the IRS lost all of Lois Lerner's emails. I mean, the only person who believes that is Rosemary Woods. I'm kind of thinking that these are the kind of political, if it's not scandals, they're shenanigans that the Democrats are really afraid of to be faced with in 2014. So I get the sense it's more of a 2014 will be a national election. And you know that Mitch McConnell is trying to paint Alison Grimes as a President Obama's running mate. And of course, she'll talk about, no, that's not true. But I mean, that's how people, win and run and campaign. So I kind of suspect that more national issues will be will win out. And I think certainly when you see the interpretation of the elections, if somebody wins or loses, you'll say, well, either Obama was an albatross or an ally.
Hey, Ken, you bring up a lot of good points. There's so much going on in the U.S. and the world right now. Is the debate over the Affordable Care Act fading as the primary political argument that's going to drive the midterm elections?
Well, Republicans certainly hope not. They certainly keep hammering the argument that premiums will go up. If they haven't gone up already, they'll go up in 2015. And that might be true. Democrats are saying that for all the concern about the botched rollout of the website, and that sounds like a million years ago, more and more people have enrolled. More and more people are covered, which is what the Obama administration wanted from the beginning. And so it's a success story. But we still have, to a person, I think almost nearly every Republican running for Congress this year has pledged to either defund it or repeal it.
And what about Iraq? I mean, the polling on President Obama's handling of this is pretty bad. And obviously we don't know what's going to, whether it's going to be effective or not, or what the next step is. But, I mean, this could go on into the fall campaign. You see this as a tough campaign issue for Democrats running for Senate?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, remember, Barack Obama was elected president in 2008, and perhaps Hillary Clinton was defeated in 2008 because of the Iraq War. She was among those Democrats who said that let's give President Bush the authority to go to war in Iraq. And all those years and thousands of deaths and billions of dollars later, I think to a person, people feel that the battle in Iraq, the war in Iraq, was not worth it. And now that we see that, you know, I mean, President Obama withdrew all troops in 2011, as he said he would do. And now there are a lot of neoconservatives saying, well, we should have left troops, because now by pulling out, we've enabled, we've given carte blanche to the Maliki government to run the show. And Maliki, who's a Shia with allies in Iran, he has done things to the Sunni minority that, of course, he promised he would not do. And there's so much anger that it led to this Sunni extremist groups, this ISIS group, the Islamic State for Iraq and Syria, that is just carving up territory and bringing this sectarian violence that we've seen for so many years in Iraq to even a higher rate.
With President Obama sending military advisors to Iraq, does he have a chance of losing some of the support he has from the left, especially if he sends in more troops at some point?
Well, you know, I mean, I tell you, when a president says, I'm sending in 300 advisors in a war, you remind of John F. Kennedy in 1961 or 63 or whatever it was. He said, I'm sending 500 advisors. And, you know, 500,000 troops later, Vietnam turned into be one of the great debacles of American foreign policy history. So I accept that the difference is Obama, I mean, for all the criticism of Obama, is a very hesitant and diffident and elusive foreign policy leader. He just knows that the American people are tired of what we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's not about to re-engage in a major way. I mean, it seems like the way to fight wars now is just to send in drones and let drones, you know, maybe killing becomes more palpable because it's more anonymous. But more and more countries are going to have drones, and maybe that's the way the war is going to be. But I mean, whether we blame Maliki, whether we blame Obama, whether we blame George W. Bush for getting rid of Saddam Hussein anyway, and then which basically put a cap on the sectarian violence, whoever you want to point the finger at, the point is that what's going on in Iraq is just horrific and scary, and it just threatens once again to open up that region to a far more of a carnage than we've seen. I mean, there was some horrific battles between 2005 and 2007 between Shia and Sunni in Iraq. And the latest incursions, the latest Sunni extremist violence seems to say that we haven't seen the last of it at all.
More with Ken Rudin after the break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, and you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with Howard Wilkinson and political junkie Ken Rudin. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
Yeah, Ken, obviously the president's approval ratings aren't very good nationally, but they seem to be even worse in some of these states where incumbent Democrats are in a fight for re-election. What do they just have to run away from him as far as they can?
Well, that's a debate that's going on in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
But basically, the answer is yes. I mean, we saw that. We've seen that in the past when George McGovern was a nominee, when Walter Mondale was a nominee, when Michael Dukakis was a nominee. They were thought, those presidential candidates were thought to bring down the Democratic label, and a lot of Democratic candidates ran away from their nominee. Now, it's different to run against your president, away from your president. But if you look at the Senate map, you know, the Senate, we've said this over and over again, Republicans need just a net gain of 6 seats to recapture the Senate. And most of these battlegrounds are in states that are red states that Mitt Romney won in 2012. Kentucky and South Dakota and West Virginia and Montana and Louisiana and Alaska and Arkansas. So those are the states where the battle for the Senate is going to be won or lost. And these Democrats know that they have a tough road. Not only Obama's numbers, the latest Wall Street Journal and NBC polls had his approval rating at 41%. And his foreign policy, I mean, we always talk about that it's the economy, stupid, but foreign policy is playing in 2014. His foreign policy approval numbers are 37%.
Yeah.
Now, is the Republican Party very popular? It's on its own? No. Do they have their own battles among themselves? Sure, they do. But when you have the leader of the free world, a leader of the country, with such poor numbers, it cannot help your party, and especially, Howard, as you say, in the states that never liked President Obama to begin with.
In these states that where there are, you know, competitive races, I mean, which ones are most likely to flip, you think, to the Republicans?
Well, I think the all but definite ones are West Virginia, where the Democrat Jay Rockefeller is retiring, and South Dakota, where the Democrat Tim Johnson is retiring. In Montana, and that's a beaut, the one where Max Baucus left, and there's a Democratic appointee who's not doing that well. I think those three states certainly go to the Republicans. They're going to also hoping to pick up North Carolina with Kay Hagan, Alaska with Mark Begich, Louisiana with Mary Landrieu. But then there are some other states, some blue states, that the Republicans suddenly think they have a shot at, like Colorado, where Mark Udall is facing a Republican congressman by the name of Cory Gardner. There's Iowa and Michigan, where Tom Harkin and Carl Levin are retiring. But for all the dream scenarios that the Republicans have, they still have to pay attention to states like Kentucky and Georgia. Now, in Georgia, the Republican incumbent is retiring, and there's going to be a Republican runoff in July. And of course, McConnell's numbers have never been great in Kentucky, as bad as Obama's numbers have been. McConnell's haven't been much better, although there is a sign that he is improving, that by running against Obama and Obama's so-called war on coal, I think McConnell's numbers are improving. And as we've said on your show many times, McConnell just knows how to win. He just knows, you know, he'll do whatever it takes to win. And I guess that's the mark of a successful politician.
And
so the Republicans do have to look at Kentucky and Georgia, but those other numbers look pretty good for them.
Yeah, and Mitch McConnell doesn't have to do it by a landslide. He doesn't care. He'll take
50 plus
I mean, one.
There's the famous John F. Kennedy quote by his father, Joe Kennedy, when he demolished Hubert Humphrey in the West Virginia primary. And Joe Kennedy apparently said, look, I spent all this money not for a landslide. If I knew it, you know, I'd get a landslide, I wouldn't have spent that much money. So you win by one vote. You know, John F. Kennedy won by 100,000 votes over Richard Nixon in 1960. You win by one vote. You win by 537 votes, as George W. Bush did over Al Gore in Florida. A win is a win is a win.
Hey, Ken, the GOP keeps getting its lumps over immigration reform, but this latest round of thousands of kids crossing the borders, is that going to point the finger at the president's immigration policies and make more people against opening up immigration and opening up amnesty?
Well, I think it does, because, I mean, you know, for all the arguments, you know, that you know, you've heard about Obama's deportation policy and immigration policy, and for all the arguments that the Republicans are politically tone deaf by not realizing about all the demographic changes that are happening in this country, and you ignore the growing Latino voting strength at your own peril, seeing all these children be crossing the border in the South, for coming in from Central America, I mean, basically, they're coming in because of the Obama policy that allows children of illegal immigrants to become U.S. citizens. So what are they doing? They're just shipping in all these kids. And for the most part, the government doesn't know what to do with it. That, a similar thing that Jimmy Carter did with this, with the Mariel boat launch from Cuba in 1980, is what defeated a guy named Bill Clinton, who was running for re-election as governor of Arkansas that year, because of defending that kind of policy, and so many immigrants wound up in Arkansas. I think that it can very well hurt the president, hurt the Democrats. I mean, look, the Republicans have used excuses not to act on immigration from the beginning. You know, the Bergdahl swap, the carbon emissions. Well, if we can't trust the president on the carbon emissions and the Bergdahl swap, how can we trust him on immigration? I mean, there's always been an excuse. But this one, I think, can touch home. And I think a lot of people say, well, wait a second, we just can't let an open border with just tens and tens of thousands of kids coming in with no, you know, just, and we were supposed to put them up somewhere. So there is a lot of controversy over that.
I know Colorado is different, but in their gubernatorial primary, Tom Tancredo lost the anti-immigration advocate.
Yeah, and I mean, the Republican establishment was holding its breath in Colorado,
right,
because Tom Tancredo, who not only ran for president as a completely illegal immigrant advocate, I mean, his rhetoric is really, really pretty harsh, but he also, in 2010, He ran as a third party candidate for governor because he didn't like the Republican Party nominee, and he came in second. I mean, the Republican Party finished third. So Tancredo had a strong base of support, but he probably had no chance in November against John Hickenlooper, the first term governor. And so the Republican Party, Bob Oprey, the former congressman, won the primary, and now he has a decent shot against Hickenlooper. You saw all the gun rights folks in Colorado rebelling against Democrats, recalling Democrats over guns and Hickenlooper's gun policies. So the Republican Party, to use a terrible choice here, dodged a bullet by having Tancredo lose the primary.
Yeah, Governor Hickenlooper would have much rather faced Tancredo then.
Oh, absolutely. Just like the Democrats would have loved to face Chris McDaniel in Mississippi. I mean, either way, I think the Republicans would have won in Mississippi, and it's much closer in Colorado. But as we learned with Sharon Angel in Nevada, as we learned with Christine, I am not a witch, O'Donnell in Delaware, we learned with Richard Murdoch in Indiana and Todd Akin in Missouri, sometimes when the Republican Party nominates very controversial candidates, their chances for winning just evaporate. And the Republican Party got the candidate they want in Colorado.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation with Ken Rudin, you can also email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
Well, I did like your Montana pun a little while ago,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that was good.
The Butte, yeah.
That was good.
Hey, Ken, what do you make of this? Former President Clinton is out there today. He's praising Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, and O'Malley might be a potential 2016 presidential candidate. Do you read anything specific into what former President Clinton is doing there?
Well, something that is interesting, because unlike Elizabeth Warren, who says, I am not running for president in 2016, Martin O'Malley is certainly testing the waters. He's been out in Iowa. He's been out, in the early states. And he's a progressive who says, look, we have to have a contested. We can't let anybody just walk in and get the nomination. So Martin O'Malley clearly wants to be president. He has great ambition. Maybe he's running for vice president, although nobody admits to running for vice president. But if there are hesitations about Hillary Clinton, we've seen some signs of her being a little tone deaf. She talked about that when they left the White House, they were dead broke, even though they've made $109 million in the past 8 years. But, she says Hillary's been saying these things that some Democrats shake their head and said, oh, no, she can't be saying this. So people like Martin O'Malley, perhaps Brian Schweitzer, the former governor of Montana, I won't use that joke again, perhaps, there are Democrats like that who say, well, maybe lightning can strike and maybe I'll run. But what people are not pointing out is that, first of all, one, nobody's talking about Chris Christie anymore on the Republican side. And two, on your website, I just checked it before I went on the air, on the WVXU website, it calls him Christ Christie. It doesn't say Chris Christie. It says Christ
typo.
Christie. And no, I think Chris Christie typed that in himself on purpose. I think it was deliberate.
Well, and that's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because, Chris Christie's facing a second bridge scandal. What in the world is up with that?
Well, Chris Christie was, we always talk about the criticism that I've just seen about Hillary Clinton the last couple of days is that she is kind of like an imperial. She has this imperial image. She admitted that she's not driven a car since 1996. Who knows who buys her groceries? She was Madam Secretary of State. She has this image that she's, not the common folk. Of course, the Hillary people will dispute that, and I understand that. But there's something about Chris Christie. From the beginning, he was just, he's a Republican in a blue state, but he was, he loved to taunt the unions, loved to taunt the journalists. He loved to, show how much disdain he has for everybody else. And now that his world is certainly falling apart, the George Washington Bridge scandal, now there's a new scandal regarding this repairing agreement with the Port Authority, not to mention the disastrous budget and economic news for New Jersey. And no longer are people talking about Chris Christie as a likely presidential nominee. And then we go back to the age-old Republican problem. Do we want somebody who could win in November against a leading Democrat like Hillary Clinton, or do we want to be ideologically pure, like perhaps a Ted Cruz? And that Republican battle is still being fought.
Yeah, which leads me to Jeb Bush. About 10 days ago, it was 10 days ago, he was here in Cincinnati at a big private fundraiser for the RNC. And I'm told they raised about $1 million just that night. and it was organized by a bunch of the old Bush pioneers from George W. Bush's campaign. Clearly he's up to something. Do you think he's serious about this?
Well, he's seriously thinking about it. I'm not convinced he's running. A lot of people are. Mm-hmm. If you look at the polls about what the rank and file, Republican rank and file feel, they're not madly in love with Jeb Bush. Not that Bush is a four-letter word, that we don't want any more about Bush and more Bushes in the White House, but he's still talking about Common Core and education and right. open outreach to immigration. He says that it's more important to win than to be ideologically pure. And there are a lot of establishment Republicans, the Mitt Romney fundraisers, in addition to the George W. fundraisers, are clearly behind Jeb Bush. But the rank and file conservatives, you know, they want the kind of rhetoric they're used to. They like the Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, you know, David Bratt. You know, David Bratt is a guy who beat Eric Cantor. You know, David Bratt mm-hmm. was outspent $5 million to $200,000, but I understand that Rob Lowe and Molly Ringwald headed up his pack. Did you know that?
No.
See,
okay.
Interesting.
Well, you know, at that Bush fundraiser.
I've been using that joke for 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good one.
At the Bush fundraiser here, there were protesters outside protesting the Common Core thing, and some, a lot of them were Tea Party people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Common Core is not popular. You saw Bobby Jindal, Louisiana, took Louisiana out of the Common Core program as well. There's a lot of internal debate in the Republican Party, what about education policy, but that's been Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush has always been that kind of person who believes in economic advantages, I'm sorry, education advantages and education programs, immigration overhaul, and that doesn't seem to be the way the Republican Party is headed, at least as we look at 2016.
And Ken, Senator Rob Portman, who's usually a pretty quiet guy, he's been out there more than usual lately, getting his positions out. You think he's thinking about running for president? You think maybe he's angling for a VP spot at this point?
Well, he was my prediction for Mitt Romney's running mate in 2016. I was convinced it was going to be Portman.
Yeah, me too.
I'm one of these Republicans. I am one of these people who are impressed with Rob Portman as a Republican national figure. I think he's smart. He's reasoned. He talks to both sides. He hasn't given up on his principles. But you're right. He's not that aggressive about presidential aspirations, but there's also John Kasich. Now, John Kasich has a re-election to worry about in November, and I suspect he does win a second term. And if he does win a second term, he, like Wisconsin's Scott Walker, these are the kind of governors that maybe the party will be talking about in 2016. More, you know, this John Kasich is certainly a conservative, but mm-hmm. he may not be as conservative as some of the more Tea Party folks would like. But that's another Ohioan that you need to who's thinking about 2016.
Ken, I understand you got a new design for your website. What's that? Tell us about that.
It's a beauty. It really is. I mean, you know, I've always had this political junkie column when I was with NPR, or even before I was with NPR, and I have the scuttle button puzzles, and we have a podcast. We have a podcast every week, and so the website is krpoliticaljunkie.com. And it's been completely revamped or redesigned. And everything is pretty, you know, it's really looking nice. You know where to find the scuttle button puzzles. If you don't know what that is, it's really a fun puzzle where I put buttons up in a vertical line and you have to guess the puzzle. So if I have a politician dressed as a chicken, I have an Ed Koch button, I have a button with the letter A on it, and I have a button of Margaret Thatcher,
yeah.
You have Chicken Cacciatore. You know, anyway. So people get it's just a lot of fun and it's entertaining. And look, I love the politics. I love talking about politics and the history and the lore and the trivia, but I also try to make it fun because I think in these tough times, and these are tough times, you just have to have a little smile on your face when you talk about these things.
Absolutely. Yep. Ken, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Political junkie Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at wvxu.org. The producer for today's program is Pete Reitmeier, and the technical director is Bruce Ellis.